This February, Jackson Lucas celebrates Black History Month on the Beyond the Resume podcast by revisiting some of our best interviews. These African-American leaders, pioneers, and industry titans have inspiring stories that hold tremendous value to this day. On behalf of all of us at Beyond the Resume, we hope you enjoyed these throwbacks. Thank you for listening.
All right, folks, I am your host, Chris Papa. Today we have a very special guest, Mr. Michael Cook. Michael is the partner at the Settled Nomad Group. How are you, Michael?
I'm good, Chris. How are you?
I'm good, man. It's good to see you here.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, you know, when you say it's good to see people, it has a very different meaning now because you're always seeing them virtual, so it's good to see people.
No, it's good to see you, man. But we've known each other for a long time now, and it's glad to, you know, we're still kicking here, still going and doing our thing, huh? So.
Yeah. It's been a long and wild ride. Lots ups and downs. Good.
So you are in Dallas, correct?
I am in Dallas. I am in North Dallas, actually, to be more specific.
How is Dallas? You like it down there?
So. You know, it's very family friendly. It's a place where you can have literally everything you can possibly imagine for your family. So all kinds of childcare, great schools, all that stuff. But I think coming from New York or even to San Francisco, it is missing a little bit of the sort of the hustle and bustle of the big city. Yeah. So good for families. But if you're young, I'd probably stick with New York or San Francisco.
I'm not young anymore, Michael. I was at some point.
Well, maybe if you're old too, though, because you know, if you're old, yeah, you don't really need family friendly as much either. So,
maybe. You know, I miss having like a yard or something though. So maybe I've actually thought my whole family's down in Houston. I grew up in New Jersey, but my family's in Houston, so I go down to Texas a lot. And I'm like, man, it seems kind of nice. So you are now the Settled Nomad Group, which is. Can you tell us a little about what you're doing lately?
Yeah, so during this pandemic, I thought it would be, and it's very risky, but I thought it'd be a really good opportunity to start my own SFR fund. I have been, and I'm sure you know this, but for the listeners, I have been in the single family rental space pretty much since it started. In 2011, GTIS Partners, where I was working, had started really researching the SFR sort of space, and we officially met our first investment in 2012, and I've been managing that ever since. And so sort of fast forward to today, and we're at a really unique point in, I think, the cycle of real estate. I think we've seen a lot of ups and downs in the economy, but we really haven't seen that reverberate at all. Yet in the greater real estate on the multifamily and on the single family side. I think we've certainly seen some stuff on the commercial side. And so I thought, well, you know, the last time we were sort of in this place, the Great Recession, SFR was a really good safe haven. And so I thought that there would be more interest in SFR. So I figured this is the best time, if any, to sort of start my own thing. And I think I've sort of built two SFR companies now, and so the third one I'm going to be building for me.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, you are the SFR guy. I mean, I remember when you were at GTIS and you guys were, I heard about you guys investing in single families houses and like, what is this stuff? Like no one was doing that. And I'm sure that turned somewhat into like street lane homes at some point, right? And then So I guess we can dig in a little deeper for those who don't really know a lot about SFR. Can you give us kind of the general, you don't have to dig in too deep, but it's kind of how did it start? What does it look like now as far as like it used to be just like, it used to be just like more mom and pops just owning a couple of houses, renting them out, right?
I mean, it still is, right? I mean, SFR at this point is only maybe 3% institution at best. So, I mean, 97% of folks are still, it's still doctors and lawyers or people who get relocated and decide they want to rent their house out. And so they rent their house and that's single family for rent. And so the challenge of doing it on a larger scale is it looks and feels a lot like multifamily, except you've got a whole bunch of operational and logistical challenges as it relates to sort of getting maintenance done, getting rents and showings and those sorts of things. But basically, yeah, single family home rental and on an institutional level is taking what folks have been doing for years with one or two or 10 homes and doing it for thousands.
And that just really happened because of the Great Recession. There was just a lot of empty houses sitting out there. No one could buy them.
Well, yeah. So, you know, the funny thing is during the Great Recession, I don't think people really approached this as a new space. I think people thought, well, housing prices are really cheap. They're, you know, 40 to 60% off of their historical highs. We can just buy them and wait. And then when they get back up to 60%, we'll sell them in bulk. We'll make money and that's it. And well, if we're holding them, we might as well rent them. And so then all of a sudden, people started realizing that when you're renting these things, you can get significant cash flow. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, multifamily was super expensive. You're getting sort of multifamily-like cash flow with much, much cheaper initial investments. And the only thing you have to figure out is how to operate it. And so sort of the evolution of the space was sort of 2012. People were buying a whole bunch of assets, really as much as they could, not even thinking about operations. And then sort of 2013, 14, 15, people started to think, hey, there's a lot of cash flow that's coming off these things. How do I operate this more efficiently? And then on top of that, real estate technology became a thing. And so you had all different types of real estate technology. So self-showings was becoming a thing. You had folks like Cast Easy who were doing lawnmowers. And so all of a sudden you had this confluence of two things coming together. You had this very operationally intensive thing that needed technology to reduce people. You had this real estate technology space that was growing rapidly. And so sort of together, you saw a huge growth in sort of this industry, and it became something that was more sustainable. Because I think when you looked at sort of how people were operating in 2011 and 12, I mean, there was no way it was sustainable. I mean, we were buying home sell spreadsheets and trying to, you know, figure out how it works. And now, you know, there's algorithms that calculate sort of that literally comb the entire MLS every hour, right? So that you don't miss a potential buying opportunity. You know, we had, when we first started, we probably had 8 different third-party property managers trying to sort of help us manage in all these different markets. Now, of course, everybody has their own property management companies. And so the evolution has been really, really quick when you sort of look at historical, other historical things, like some multifamily in the 90s. The evolution of single family has been fairly quick. And now it's in a place where I think it is really sort of a solid and strong institutional asset class.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, there's some big, really big players out there, a lot of big money out there involved in this. What is happening now in that space? I have not been involved personally, like involved with that space for a little while. Are there, there's still a lot of homes to be purchased? Is it consolidating? Is it buying from these mom and pops? Is it buying, renting out, buying newly built houses now? What are the different varieties?
Yeah. So I think that when you look at the space in general, there has definitely been some consolidation. I think that in the beginning when it first started, everyone was trying to get into it. And so I think you had people taking different strategies. You had people taking different geographic areas. You had people investing a lot in operations, investing a lot in technology. And I think that that's sort of all winnowed down now. And so you sort of got the winners. So you got the Invitation Homes, you've got the Progress, you got American Homes for Rent, Tricon, some of those larger folks, Main Street Renewal, that have really been able to capture an outsized portion of the investor dollar. So today, I think when most sort of large pension funds think about where they're going to put their money in SFR, they're choosing those sort of larger firms. And then you have this sort of, and those are all firms that I would say, you know, easily, you know, 20,000 homes or more. They have the buying capacity to buy anywhere from, you know, several hundred to 1,000 homes a month if they want to. More recently, you've also started to see build for rent become a thing. You know, honestly, it's been a thing for probably 3 years, but it's become much more of a thing. And I think that you're seeing folks really try to figure out every possible way that they can get their operations to be easier. And build for rent, I think when people finally actually did the math of, yeah, I'm paying a small premium for this new house, but I do so much less in repairs and other things. it makes a lot of sense. And so, you know, you have folks that have really just started mind built to rent communities. I think sort of early on, I think people were cautious that rental was going to have some kind of a stigma. But I think with the institutionalization of the space in general and more people renting, really preferring to rent, that hasn't been the case. And so you're seeing a lot more. You're seeing builders do it. Yeah. You know, you mentioned Houston. There's a large builder in Houston, Camello Homes. I mean, they've got a huge, they probably have 4,000 or 5,000 homes themselves. And then you have folks that are going even further. I mean, American Homes for Rent, for example, they are buying land now, and they have built their own sort of home building.
Oh, wow.
Because ultimately, not only do they need to sort of build the homes, but they're building homes that are really designed for renters. And so there's a lot of little elements that probably too detailed to get into here, but there's a lot of little elements you can do that make it easier to sort of manage, especially like a subdivision of homes.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to continue that way. And I think the one thing we haven't seen in SFR yet is really folks playing on the lower side. I think, you know, most people play in that sort of $150,000 to $300,000 space. There still is a lot of room for folks to either focus on sort of subsidized housing or be in that sort of $150,000 and below, sort of the, you know, think of it as like C-class multifamily, yeah. Right? Like there's a lot of A-class multifamily, but there's also B, C, and even D-class multifamily. And I think in SFR, we definitely have A and B, but we really don't have that sort of B minus C player yet.
Is that possible for people think to get subsidized single family rentals? Is that something that's out there?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So and when I say subsidized, I just mean like Section 8. Yeah. Like they're definitely Section 8 rentals. And, you know, it is very much the same process, right? And so it's really just about being able to, understand exactly what the Section 8 requirements are and how that works in your rental house. And then being able to sort of leverage that over a much larger portfolio. And again, different geographies and other things, but they're all separate laws.
Interesting. And now what you said that there's computer programs and technology that's combing the MLS. What are they looking for when they're, what makes a good SFR purchase?
Yeah, I mean, they're looking for the typical buy box. So from an SFR standpoint, the smaller, the better. So your sweet spot is 3 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms, as small as possible. So if you can get 3 bedrooms, 2 bathroom, 1200 to 1500 square feet, you're looking at areas where your rent is going to be just for general purposes, you know, 10% of your purchase price. And then you're looking for schools that are good, not great. I mean, ultimately it's going to be a rental. And so folks will be fine with sort of the 4, 5, 6 school range. You're looking for something fairly close to retail and or employment, and with low crime. And so you can take census data, you can take property tax data. There's a lot of public data you can take and feed it into your system, along with Zillow rental feeds. And, it's fairly complex, but there's enough either public data or data for purchase out there where you can have a computer program basically say, I only want to see these number of homes. And generally, you know, once you do that, then you've got, you know, a bunch of analysts sort of looking at these homes trying to figure out, okay, now that these meet our buy box, what do the renovations look like? Are the rents, do the rents still make sense? They're just checking over the things that, potentially machines could miss. But other than that, I mean, frankly, some of the larger SFR players are looking at machine learning such that they can have a machine look at pictures and tell you how much the renovation is. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of stuff that's coming.
That's amazing. All right, enough about SFR. Enough about that. What about Michael? Now, you've been an executive in some big, you know, famous funds out there. Now you're an entrepreneur. Tell me about you. Where did you grow up? I mean, did you see a house once and say, hey, one day I'm going to rent that house out, buy that and rent it out? Like where did all this stuff start out?
No. So I grew up on the South Side of Chicago. I honestly, I would say I got my love of real estate young. My dad was a police officer and my mom works for the state of Illinois. Those are both jobs that had great pensions and it was very sort of working class. And one of the things that they did early on was they were looking just for rentals, for places to sort of park their cash where they could get income. They had a couple of rentals and, you know, it was fine. But I found real estate to be like the most tangible thing. As I grew up, I ended up eventually going to Cornell University undergrad. I started off doing sales and marketing at Procter & Gamble. I remember this like it was yesterday. So my first job was in San Francisco.
Oh, okay.
And with that job came a bonus of like $5,000. And I took that bonus and I said, you know what? I want to buy a house with that first initial bonus. And now this is 2002. I took that bonus money and I bought a really small condo in Concord, California. It was not the Concord you know today. It was pretty rough.
It was actually pretty rough.
Back in the day, but I was excited because I just graduated college and I owned my own.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was really stoked about that. I realized very quickly that I did not like sales and marketing. But to be fair, I wasn't actually even in California for that. I played volleyball in college and I had dreams of joining the Olympic team. And so I was actually playing volleyball. I was sort of working this side job that was actually a real job. but because it was a sales job, it was basically once you sort of met your sales quota, you're done. So I would work really hard the first like 7 days of the month and then meet sales quota. And then I had my time. But anyway, back to the real estate portion. So
that's awesome.
I took the house that I had in Concord, and I lived there for a year. Once my volleyball dreams got crushed, and I decided I had to be like a working for
working stiff.
I focused on my job and I got promoted. I moved to Detroit, and because I was sort of riding the real estate wave, I sold that condo in California, bought three houses in Detroit.
Whoa.
I sort of started my first business there. I started my own sort of fix and flip and rental business out of college. And I was super excited about it until it became like overwhelming. I was literally doing handyman work. I was sleeping in my basement. I was doing everything. I was like, you know, this doesn't make sense. There's got to be a better way. And so I went back to business school, focused on real estate finance. And then went the investment banking route. And so that is how I sort of got into real estate.
That makes sense. So you did that and then you were on the banking route and then you went the private equity route and that's how you kind of learned about the SFR stuff. And just grew from there. Would you recommend that to someone who's wants to get into real estate finance and maybe doesn't have the background in finance to go get your MBA or?
So here's the thing. I think ultimately the MBA is great for switching careers and giving you access. I can safely say I learned nothing. I should say that I'm recorded.
Wow. No one's listening anyways, Michael, don't worry.
I learned a ton. But to be honest, I think the purpose of business school is much more, I would say, networking and really being able to sort of immerse yourself in something. So I found that while the classroom stuff wasn't that amazing, the networking I did with my peers and the entrepreneurial type projects you get to do yourself sort of outside of the classroom were really valuable. When I was there, I did a project on turning a dead mall into condos. And there was just a number of interesting sort of real estate projects I did that sort of got my mind thinking. Also sort of wrapping my mind around what sort of real estate is on a larger scale. Business school definitely helped transition that. The one thing I would recommend, though, is investment banking. I think there's nothing like investment banking for a sheer training ground for a knowledge base in finance, period. I think once you have done sort of 3 years in investment banking, it's like doing 7 years in a normal career. Yeah. But more importantly, I mean, you literally from day one get to see how CEOs think, you get to see how businesses run, and you spend a lot of time doing grunt work. But every now and again, you get these really amazing experiences where, and I will recount one. So for the New York folks, Scott Reckler is a RXR guy, right? So early on, I was at Wachovia, and we were putting together a fund for RXR. And I was working in their offices in Long Island. And I remember it must have been 2 a.m. And I was working with an analyst, and Scott comes in the office at 2 a.m. And he sees that the lights are on. So he peeks in. He knows we're there. He knows what we're doing. And he just stops in to talk to us, which I thought was really cool. He just stops in and talks to us. And he's like, wow, you know, you guys first, he says, we had one of his properties on the board, and we had sort of cash flows, we had the returns. And he said, you know, that IRR doesn't look right for that property. Now, this is, you know, one of probably 30 properties that he has, but he was sort of drilling in on this IRR at 2 a.m. But then he just sort of sat down and talked to us for like 10 minutes. He was like, hey, you know, what do you guys sort of want to do with your careers, this sort of thing? And I said, you know, I think it's really cool what you're doing. Someday I'd love to like have my own fund. But right now I'm just trying to, you know, just trying to grind this out. And he said, well, you know, tell me about your day. And I said, well, honestly, the car comes to get me at 7 o'clock, and then it drops me off at 2 a.m. And that's it. And then I hear. and he says, well, you know, the key is the amount of sleep you're getting now, just keep that up. And then he walks me through like his day, and I was just amazed at, like, you know, he talked about waking up like 5 a.m, sort of reading a newspaper, getting in all the real estate financial news, and then taking time to walk through, you know, spend some time with his kids and his family. Then he goes to work, and then after that he's got dinners, and then after that he's got like, there was just so much stuff that he's fitting into the day. And he's like, well, listen, you know, there's just not time for 8 hours of sleep. And it was powerful in that it helped me understand like what work is. Like, work is not this like 8 hour thing. Like, work is sort of a state of being. And it's ultimately, I think it really sort of that one small conversation really influenced sort of my mindset around sort of going to work.
Yeah. Well, especially, I mean, you were in New York too. I mean, you're working for some really high caliber funds after Wells. I mean, you've worked in New York, San Francisco, Dallas. I mean, is there a big difference in work cultures in all these different cities?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think the thing about New York is it's really sort of a work hard, play hard kind of place. And I think the thing about San Francisco is it's just kind of a work hard. And it's sort of a work hard, but sort of pretend like you don't work that hard. And I think New York is just like, there's no bones about it. It's like, this is what we do. Whereas in San Francisco, like, they have a lot of companies have these like little like fun, like, oh, hey, you got, you know, unlimited vacation, like these sorts of things that like make you feel like, oh, this is great. But then when the rubber meets the road, the work still has to get done. And so I find that people in San Francisco still work a lot, but they somehow feel like they have better balance when they,
because they're not wearing a suit. So they feel like, you know.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, you don't wear a suit. But the other thing, the funnier thing too, I find the folks in New York to also, there's a different kind of entitlement, I think, in San Francisco because of the way tech is and because of the fact that there are so many young people who have had success so early. I find that, you know, we literally had to move our company from San Francisco to Dallas because we couldn't keep an analyst. Like, analysts thought, you know, I'm going to be here for a year and then I'm Mark Zuckerberg and I'm out of here. And so, you know, it was hard to really help people understand, the grind that they needed to have to sort of get to those places, but then B, just to keep them, because there was just so many competitive folks out there sort of pulling at everything. So I don't know. I found San Francisco to be a little bit more challenging.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I think they work hard in both those places.
Now, you started out after banking and asset management. Now, not everyone does that route. I mean, as a recruiter, it's like everyone wants, I want acquisitions. I mean, what do you find it was beneficial to be in the asset management side? I mean, I see the whole spectrum. So I think it's beneficial, but what did you learn doing that? And do you think it really helped you in your career?
So for me, it works for me because I love problem solving. Like for me, it's, I love like solving puzzles and I love that sort of thing. And so ultimately for me, asset management was, you have this established business that has some kind of a problem and you need to figure out how to maximize its value. And so going and thinking about all these problems and really when I started GTIS, I think what gave me success there was, I got to GTIS in 2011, but really sort of just post the great financial crisis and when things had really taken a turn. And so we had everything from hotels to industrial to office, and they all had a variety of sort of problems. And so being able to sort of really get into the operations and say, okay, this is an interesting problem. How can we fix this here? And seeing it on so many different levels, I think ultimately made me a better executive down the line. That being said, I mean, I certainly wouldn't disparage acquisitions or dispositions or brokerage or all of the different aspects of real estate. But I think that you really have to find what fits your personality. And for me, I found acquisitions to be boring. I think that there's a lot of people that sort of get excited about like buying stuff, but ultimately it's like you always have a buy box, and if it falls in the buy box, then you're going to buy it. And ultimately, every time, no matter what I've seen, every time you put together this great acquisition plan, and then 4 years going to do this, and then 5 years we're going to sell it, it never works.
Yeah.
And so you ultimately always end up needing to find someone that could sort of help you get through the operations. And so to me, I always found asset management to be the most interesting aspect of real estate. And that's what drew me to it. So I am probably biased, but I do think it sort of then prepares you overall to sort of be a better executive. But that, again, personal perspective.
Well, they say you're gonna buy well and then manage well, right? And so now you're on your own. You took the plunge, or whatever you want to call it. What is your day consist of now? What is an entrepreneur starting a new fund dude?
So there's a complexity to it that I did not appreciate. There is a back office. There's an amount of back office that you have supporting you when you work for a larger company. You don't even care about. Because I have started many a fund before, and I just sort of let the lawyers do the work, and I don't really think about the bills and all the other stuff because ultimately, you know, we're raising $500 million, and so $1 million legal bill, whatever. Whereas now, when I'm starting a $20 million fund, the legal bills are much more important. They actually, they're a much larger influence. So, when I first decided this, I probably spent the first week just like putting together the model and making sure that it all worked. But then since then, I have spent probably, if I was to walk you through a typical day, it's review sort of documents from legal. So the PPM is sort of being completed as we speak. We're working on getting all of our marketing materials approved so that we can go to market. There's a lot of legal stuff you can't do and can't say in presentations. You got to get all that stuff done. We are making sure the track record that we have is efficient, all that stuff. And then on top of that, so that's probably the first hour and a half of the day. Then I am going on property tour. So I'm looking at competitive properties to make sure that sort of our renovation spec and scope makes sense. And so that what we can actually go to market with actually works. I'm looking at potential acquisitions. So I'm looking at, so I don't have this fancy algorithm, all the things that you take for granted. So I have my own sort of MLS feed that I get, that I've sort of programmed. And so, you know, I get 30 or 40 houses a day. I'm just looking through so that I can understand. So I can say, hey, when we start this fund, this is going to happen. After that, it's about the networking piece. So probably the last half of the day is really either calling or contacting folks, family offices who I know that could potentially be investors, taking folks out to lunch, trying to connect with folks who might be interested. Oh, well, I forgot. There's the other piece of all of the corporate documents and other things. So in addition to starting the fund, in order to support the fund, you got to start your own property management company. That means you got to hire some folks. That means you got to do all this other stuff. And so that's sort of the last couple hours of the day. So it's not something that I think that I thought would be easy, but I think the aspects that I thought would be hard are easy. The aspects that I thought would be easy are quite hard.
That's funny. And now, are you have you made the announcement? I mean, are you out there? Are you public with this, or are you still kind of behind the scenes waiting?
So we have another probably 2 weeks or so before we get all of our documents done. And then we can, because we're doing sort of a Reg D offering. And so we'll be able to really sort of go public with this probably in the next 4 weeks.
Awesome, man. Well, I'm looking forward to hearing about it. And we are hearing about it, but you know, I want to hear the name. That's what excites me the most. That's the hardest part, right? Picking the name.
Yeah, no, this name will not excite.
Houses for Rent by Michael.
That's very close. But you know, the cool thing about the fun though, and the cool thing about the discussions, I think, not only have I seen people be very concerned about the market in general and looking for defensive spaces, but I think people are also hungry for yield. And I think the problem that people are facing now is with interest rates so low, there's no really good safe haven.
Yeah.
And on top of that, the potential risk and volatility in the real estate markets have been really amped up, I think, now, just given all of the data that people are seeing. So we've actually gotten a lot of good feedback on SFR as a strategy. And I think that SFR in general, not just us, but a lot of people are seeing a lot more money flow to SFR.
Yeah, totally. I mean, as an individual investor myself, it's one thing I look at as well. Awesome, man. Well, looking forward to hearing about the when the name drops in a couple weeks. Maybe we won't release it till the name drops so we can put it out there as the big reveal. So now, are you ready for the hot seat? All right. Any books you recommend, whether it's regarding real estate, business, life, anything that you want?
Sure. So, the first book that I read when I was younger is actually Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And I think that I liked the book because of its simplicity. I think that as I've gotten a little bit older, the simplicity is, there's a lot more nuance to it. But I think that there's some basic things that takeaways that I like a lot from that book. The other book that I think has really transformed my life is the 10,000 Hours book by Malcolm Gladwell. I think that a lot of people have taken that towards sports, but I think if you take that same attitude towards your career and business or life in general, I think whatever you sort of really focus on and spend your time on, you can see some outsized gains. And oftentimes I think people get frustrated if they spend a certain amount of time, they don't get far enough. If they just continue to push through, they might get a little bit further. And so those are the two books, like, just off the top that I'd say these are great. I have read some, I am reading some books right now, but they're not as transitional or transformative.
I didn't read Rich Dad Poor Dad till like my 40s. So I wish I read it 20, 30 years earlier. It's definitely like a mindset shift, right? How about podcast recommendations?
So I will go across the board here. So there's a fantastic podcast called Ear Hustle. It's actually about the prison system, and they have a number of inmates, which gives you an interesting insight into what it's like to be an inmate in prison. It was just really interesting. I don't have another great descriptor. It's not real estate. It's just a really interesting podcast that talks about the prison system, but gives you a real perspective from an inmate's perspective. So it was really interesting. From a real estate podcast standpoint, like I said, I have my own podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm dropping soon that I will plug.
Coming out in 2 weeks too?
I'm trying to have it all come out together. So the fund and then social media and everything, just so that it's,
we're going to hold this back until it comes out. So we can put the name in there.
So there's that, and then another Malcolm Gladwell. I am a fan of his, but he's got a revisionist history podcast. That's a really good one because I think it really, again, it helps you look at things just from a different perspective. I think that one of the challenges with sort of media today in general is that it's very sort of black and white, and I think that there's a lot of grays in there that it's hard to that you don't really get. And so those are the two that I'd recommend. Again, non-real estate. I will say that I spend a lot of my non-real estate time not doing real estate.
Yes.
So when I'm working, I'm working. But when I'm not working, I kind of don't really want to hear or talk about real estate just because I think I spend so much time on it.
I listen to like soccer podcasts. That's generally what I listen to, soccer podcasts. Like, I don't want to think about recruiting or business. I just want to think about something else for a little bit. Now, what do you like to do outside of work?
So I mentioned that I played volleyball a lot when I was younger. I am crossing my fingers that I'll be able to start coaching soon. I love spending time with kids. My kids are a little too young. I've got 2 4-year-olds and a 6-year-old. And they're just starting soccer. And so I've done a little bit of coaching, which I love that a lot. I love the coaching and the teaching side. Honestly, I have not had a lot of other time. My only other time has been relaxing at night with a cigar every now and again. That is really it. This pandemic has really made me question the number of hobbies I have. Like, really,
yeah. Same thing, man. The same exact thing. I'm like, wow, I got to start doing things besides working. Now, what advice would you give to your 20-year-old self?
So I would say to my 20-year-old self, give the entrepreneurship thing a chance earlier. I think the thing for me that has always been a holdback, or it's always been sort of a mental, like, if I had all of these tools, then I can do this. And now that I'm actually starting to do the entrepreneur thing, I realize I could have done this so much earlier. Like, I realized that waiting to have every single thing, like, right? Like, I wanted to check all the boxes, right? I wanted to be a chief operating officer. I wanted to, have a track record of, this many deals and all that stuff. And I think that what you realize is that ultimately, you're making a lot of money for a lot of other people. And there's something wrong with that, right? Because you're certainly getting paid for it. Ultimately, I think that I would have said to my younger self, be more entrepreneurial faster, take the lessons you're learning, and then have more confidence in, your ability to sort of sell yourself to the market. That would be the number one.
Nice. Good one. Now, I am a recruiter, and so there's people on here probably looking for advice how to get jobs. What do you look for in hiring people, whether it's, technical skill set / just soft skills?
So I'm not going to give one of those like fluffy answers. I think that in this day and age, you should have a very good knowledge of Excel. Like, if you're working in real estate, you should understand real estate pro formas, period. I don't care what your job is, whether you're a real estate broker, whether you're asset management acquisitions, it doesn't matter. You should have a very strong knowledge of Excel. You should have a very strong knowledge of a real estate pro forma. You should be able to look at revenues, expenses, and get down to NOI. You should be able to understand exactly sort of what makes each of those things up. And then you should be able to intelligently figure out sort of either what's the thing that's lagging or what's the thing that, we can improve, right? And so, for example, right now I'm hiring a property manager. And ultimately, I have a model and I know exactly what I want my properties to be producing. And every single home has a model. So I need that person be conversant enough to be able to actually look at this and say, okay, these are the rents I'm collecting, these are the expenses. How does it match up to that model? Is that the same? Is it similar? And then I would love for them to be able to say, instead of me having to like look at that and say, hey, have you looked at these three things? For them to come to me and say, oh, hey, I've noticed that these three things are off, right? And so ultimately, when I'm looking for someone, and this is on all sides of the business, I need somebody that can sort of speak the language of real estate, which right now is Excel and performance. And I don't care whether you're a maintenance man or whether you're a property manager or any of those things, you need to be able to understand, especially because I do think the industry, our industry, is moving towards KPIs. So I think there's a lot of folks that are on key performance indicators. And so in order to, you know, understand your key performance indicator, you need to be conversant in numbers. So that to me is sort of the number one thing I'm looking for. And you even, you know, again, you need to be technology savvy. And then I would say, you know, the other thing is obviously personable. There is a personality piece to it. And I think ultimately, I don't think anybody would say that I'm the most personable guy, but at the end of the day, they know I'm honest, I'm fair, and I'm going to be a good guy to work with. And so it's just those two things for me are sort of the ticket to the door. And once you got that, I can teach you the rest.
I think you're a personable guy. So there you go. Michael Cook, great getting to know you better. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
No problem. Chris, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Resume, a Jackson Lucas podcast where we take a deep dive into the career journeys of some of the top minds in real estate and equip you with the knowledge to move forward in your path towards the success you've envisioned. Make sure to like, share, and subscribe to Beyond the Resume. Be grateful for your support. All episodes of Beyond the Resume are brought to you by Jackson Lucas, building inclusive and diverse businesses through talent acquisition. Visit us at jacksonlucas.com